Show you two pages I showed last session. Why? Because you might have already forgotten about them. I said when you sit down to value business, I said you can value the equity in the business or the whole business. And I said the contrast is when you value the equity in the business, you look at the cash flows left over after debt payments, and you discount them back at the rate of return that equity investors demand, which is the cost of equity, get a value of equity. The other is to value the whole business. What does this mean? Well, you take the cash flows before debt payments and you discount them back at a cost of capital, a weighted average, and what you get is the value of the business. You subtract out debt to get to the value of equity. Okay? Two ways to get the value of equity. Do you think banks, consulting firms, we call that one of the first principles, right? Don't mismatch. Do you think banks and consulting firms, et cetera, ever mismatch? They're filled with MBAs from top business schools. They're paid a lot of money. You would think they wouldn't, right? So I'm going to take you back in time to a page. It's difficult to read, but it comes from a Harvard Business School case study. Now, one of the things you have to remember about Harvard Business School case studies is every Harvard Business School case study, no matter what discipline it is a strategic case study, which means the numbers don't really matter. It's all about how you spin stuff. And this was about a company called Kennecott. So I'll set the basis for the story. In the late 1970s, Kennecott, which was a copper mining company, was forced to divest itself of a coal mining subsidiary called Peabody Coal. Why? Because antitrust laws kicked in, and they said, and they went out and divested Peabody Coal, and they ended up with about $600 million in cash from the sale, which they immediately viewed as a problem. Why? Because they didn't have a use for the cash, and they were worried that if they had the cash, somebody would try to acquire them and kind of use the cash to cover the acquisition. Let me ask you a question. This is a very common sense question. You're a company. You have $600 million in cash that you don't have a use for. You're worried that somebody might use that cash to acquire you. What's the most sensible way to get rid of that cash? Just give it back to the stockholders, right? Pay dividends. That thought never even crossed their minds. So what would they do with all that money? Do stupid things like pay bills and how? No, you can't allow that. So let me ask you a follow-up question. What's the stupidest and quickest way to get rid of $600 million cash? Invite an investment banker and say, can you help me spend the cash? This is like walking into Bloomingdale's, waving $5,000. Can you help me spend it? I have a lot of money to spend. You'll have a lot of salespeople. They work on commission surrounding you for the rest of the day. So Kennecott went to an investment bank called First Boston. It's now CSFB, but at that time, the leading M&A bank on the street, and they said, can you help us spend $600 million? Can you find us a target firm? And First Boston said, can we find you a target firm? And they went out and found a target firm, and they say, this is magical, but the firm we found, you can buy for just $600 million. This is one of the rules in acquisitions. The value of a target company will magically rise to however much money you have to spend on your balance sheet. So this was actually the table that First Boston used to justify the $600 billion acquisition. The Harvard Business School never meant this to be the centerpiece of the case. So you were supposed to talk about, should a copper mining company buy, you know. So the target company they picked was a company called Carborundum, a company that makes abrasives, sandpaper, metallic abrasives. But I want to focus in on how First Boston valued Carborundum. I know there are lots of numbers on this. I'll tell you what they did, and then I'm going to ask you a question at the end. So I want you to kind of follow the next minute or two. Here's what First Boston did. They projected the revenues at Carborundum for the next 10 years and beyond. They subtracted out the operating expenses. They came up with the operating income, then they subtracted interest expenses from the debt you would have to come up with net income. And then they subtracted out, you know, the CapEx, working capital. And they also subtracted out debt payments you might have to make along the way. That's how they got the cash flows. That's all I'm going to tell you. That's the cash flow I'm discounting. I want you to tell me, and you know enough about valuation now to help me out here, you have to pick the right discount rate to apply to these cash flows. So remember, Carborundum is the target firm. Kennecott is the acquiring firm. The cash flows they've estimated are for Carborundum. They're after interest and principal payments. So I'm going to give you six possible numbers here. One of them is the right number. The other five are wrong. Let's see whether you can latch on to the right number. So let's start easy. Should I be discounting these cash flows at the cost of equity or the cost of capital? How did I describe the cash flows? What did I say they did? They projected out the operating income. Then I said they subtracted out interest expenses. It's cash flows to equity, debt. So the discount rate has to be a cost of equity. So you can draw an X through the cost of capital. You shouldn't be using it. Now comes the tricky question that half the people who do M&A get wrong every single time I ask them. You need to discount these cash flows, right? Here are your choices. You can discount those cash flows at the acquiring company's cost of equity. After all, they raised the money to do the acquisition. You can discount these cash flows at the target company's cost of equity. So the cash flows, the target company. Or maybe you want to get fancy and use some blended cost of equity of what the cost of equity would be for the combined firm. So I want you to think about that for 30 seconds because this is going to make or break this valuation. How many of you think I should use the acquiring company's cost of equity? Don't worry, keep your hand up. I will put you on the spot, but remember, half of all bankers would have done what he did. And what's the rationale you would give? It's raising the money. After all, it says cost of capital, right? Basically, it's a cost of raising money. My cost of raising money is, you know what rule you've just violated in capital budgeting? And this is a mistake that comes from the fact we call it cost of capital. You know what the discount rate for a project in capital budgeting is supposed to be? It's a rate that reflects the risk of the cash flows on the project, not the risk of the entity looking at the project. So if you're a safe entity looking at a risky project, what should you do? You should use a high discount rate. So if you're a cable company looking at entering into the social media business, you shouldn't be using your cable cost of equity or capital to discount it because it's a riskier business. So let me reframe. Now it's going to be easy because it's unfair because I picked on him to use it. How many of you think I should use the target company's cost of equity? The rest of you are just thinking, or are you going to pick the blended? It sounds more complex, so it must be the right answer kind of thing, right? The right answer is always the target company's discount rate. There are no exceptions, no maybe, could be. When you value a target company, you should be valuing it based on the target company's characteristics, not the acquiring company, not some blended company, because if you do, you're going to end up subsidizing risky business with safe business. You see why I call it subsidizing? I told you half of all acquisitions screw up on this very basic element. So of all these numbers, what should I be using? I should be using a 16.5% cost of equity. Question.
What if the industry that you're buying is the same industry as yours?
Well, then your cost of equity is going to be pretty similar. The rule doesn't change, right? So then their cost of equity is going to be similar. It still is not an excuse for using your cost of equity. It just turns out, coincidentally in this case, you're a chemical company buying a chemical company. The cost of equities are pretty close. It's still the same principle. It's just in this case, you could violate the principle and probably not pay a price, at least in the short term. Okay. So, yes? No. It just makes it a bad acquisition that you frame in the wrong way to your shareholders. So the fact that you market a bad product doesn't make it a good idea, right? So you're saying I can, and maybe this explains what First Boston did. Now, if you were to pick the worst possible answer here, 16.5% is the right discount rate. If you wanted to really screw up big time, which discount rate in this table are you going to pick? You know what Kennecott ended up using? First Boston ended up using? It ended up using Kennecott's cost of capital. Wrong discount rate, wrong company. This is about as far as you can get from the right answer. You're saying, what's the big deal? Cost of equity, cost of capital, who cares? Well, they used a 10.5% discount rate instead of a 16.5% discount rate. Their value was $650 million, which justifies paying $600 million. But if I had used the right discount rate, they'd have had four. They just caused me to make a $200 million mistake. And this was the premier M&A bank on this. You know, the lesson I'm trying to say is now don't go work for CSFB. if that's what, where you end up. I'm saying just because you see a big name on a valuation, Goldman Sachs, KKR, don't assume they know what they're doing, because they don't. You know who ran First Boston at the time of this deal? Two men who are legendary in M&A, Bruce Wasserstein and Joe Perella. They're part of M&A legend. Bruce's nickname was Bid 'em Up Bruce. Basically, he got, and he was completely open about the fact that he didn't care about value, he'd get deals done. In fact, somebody asked him about, you know, a big deal he did about 6 years later where, you know, people overpaid. It was actually the Bloomingdale's deal, and somebody asked him, weren't you worried about paying too much? He said, my job is to get the deal done first and worry about value afterwards. He died about a decade ago. This should be put on his tombstone. Did deal first, worried about value. What's worrying about value afterwards going to get you? Are you going to write a letter to shareholders saying, guys, we overpaid by mistake. Could you please mail back $15 per share to us because that's how much you overpaid? Consistency. So when you look at a DCF, don't just assume that, you know, because somebody's done it, then check, always check to see what are the cash flows, are there before debt payments or after debt payments, and is the right discount rate being applied. So let's go back to the notes where we left off and talk a little bit more about discount rates today. So last session, when I left you off, I talked about the ingredients in a DCF, right? There's cash flows. Those cash flows can either be dividends, if you really want to be lazy and take whatever's being paid out. They can be potential dividends, where you estimate what the dividend should be. Or they can be cash flows before debt payments, in which case the cash flows the firm. The discount rate can be either a cost of equity, if you're discounting cash flows to equity, or cost of capital. The growth rate can either be a growth rate in operating income, if you're valuing the entire business, or growth rate in equity income. And then at the end, you put some closure on it, and you walk away. So you're doing the same thing. You're just framing the valuation differently. But embedded in all of discounted cash flow models is a discount rate. So let's start there. What exactly is this discount rate? What do I bring in? Now, the way I frame discount rates is this is where you show the risk in your investment, and higher risk investment should have higher discount rates. Easily said, right? So what I want to do is talk a little bit first about consistency in discount rates, building on what we just talked about. If your cash flows are to equity, we said use the cost of equity. Cash flows of firm, cost of capital. Why? You want to be consistent. If your cash flows are in Indonesian rupiah, your discount rate has to be in Indonesian rupiah. So the same consistency issue applies when you pick a currency. And if you choose to do your valuation in real terms, what does that mean? When you project numbers out, you don't get the benefit of inflation. You take inflation out. Then your discount rate has to be a real discount rate. You tell me how you estimate the cash flows. I'll pick the discount rate that matches the cash flows. So let's start with that question of where in the discounted cash flow model risk shows up and what kinds of risk you will bring into your discount rate. So if you look at it from a big picture perspective, in your numerator you have expected cash flows, not conservative, not best case, not worst case, but expected. So don't double count risk by trying to lower it and saying, I'm feeling a little uncomfortable, I'll use a lower number. Don't haircut the cash flows. Another practice that people often use in valuation, you want haircutting the cash flows, is you present cash flows and say, oh, I feel a little uncertain, let me knock off 20%. Expected cash flows, in the denominator, you have a discount rate. And if you look at the ingredients, no matter how complicated the model you are, you always start with a risk-free rate in the currency you're doing the analysis. And we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about how to estimate that risk-free rate. You then measure the relative risk of a company. Is it more risky than average, less risky, whether you use a beta or something else, and look at the alternatives, that's what you're measuring. And then you look at the price of risk in the equity market called an equity risk premium. Risk-free rate, beta, equity risk premium. Now, before we get too involved in estimating these numbers, let's first talk about risk. When you sit down to value a company, here's an exercise that's worth doing. It's actually cathartic. It could make you feel much better. Sit down and start listing everything that you worry about in this company. Can you imagine doing this for Tesla? I'm worried about the automobile business. I'm worried about green energy. I'm worried about it. I'm worried about Elon Musk. I'm worried about Elon Musk's girlfriend. I'm worried. And basically, the list goes on and on. Just put it all there. You're going to have dozens of items of risk there, right? And on top of that, you also have going to have risk. Like, what if interest rates go up? What if we go to recession? What if the coronavirus, you know, becomes, you know, is the corona? That's the beer. But basically, whatever the virus is, that's will it affect? So you will have 3 pages of risk that you're exposed to as a company. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to then take those risks and start putting them into buckets. Here's the first set of buckets. Is that risk estimation risk or economic risk? I call it estimation uncertainty, economic uncertainty. Let me explain the difference. When you sit down to project the revenue growth for Tesla, and I hope you take that weekly, the valuation of the week, and try them. This estimation uncertainty, you know, estimation uncertainty comes from the fact that you haven't done your homework enough, that maybe you should go check to see how many Tesla 3s were produced. So estimation uncertainty you can reduce by collecting more information in the company. You know where economic uncertainty comes from? It comes from outside. No matter how much data you collect, you cannot forecast out what percentage of people will buy electric cars in the future. Economic uncertainty is uncertainty that lurks out there, that no matter how much information you collect and no matter how much time you spend on Google search, it's not going to go away. I have some really bad news for you when you do valuation. 85 to 90% of the uncertainty in a company like Tesla is economic uncertainty. It's not estimation uncertainty. It's not because you haven't done your homework or collected data. It's because nobody knows what's going to happen. Now do you see why you need to stop collecting data at some point? Because many of you, as you sit down to do valuations, that if I collect more data, things are going to get clearer. Let me collect more data. Let me collect more. You got to stop because economic uncertainty is going to be there no matter how much data you collect. Estimation versus economic. Uncertainty can be micro uncertainty or macro uncertainty. What's micro-uncertainty? Micro-uncertainty is uncertainty specific to the company. So will Elon Musk keep tweeting or not tweeting is micro-uncertainty. Will those assembly lines in Shanghai actually turn out 140,000 cars is micro-uncertainty. You know what the macro-uncertainty is? How quickly will the global economy grow? Will it be affected by, you know, whatever? Will interest rates go up? That's macro-uncertainty. You say, why do you care? I'm going to say something, and I'll come and back it up. If you're an investor who's diversified, you have a portfolio, the uncertainty that you build into discount rates is just the macro uncertainty. Why is that? Why do I not worry about what's happening at the company level if I'm diversified? Remember, what happens at the company level can be either good news or bad news, right? And if I have 50 companies in my portfolio, over time, what are you going to find? What happens in individual? It's a law of large numbers, right? In statistics, basically, some companies are going to do better than expected, and some companies are going to do worse than expected. The company-specific risk is going to start to average out. Obviously, this won't work if you take all your money and buy Tesla. But if Tesla is one of 50 companies in your portfolio, as it was in mine, the company-specific risk will not show up in the discount rate, and that's a tough, intuitive climb for many people. Like, for instance, you buy into a young pharmaceutical company, a very young biotechnology company. It's got a product working its way through the pipeline. What's the biggest risk you worry about? That the product might not be approved. You know what? Your discount rate will not be high for that company. You're saying, but I want to punish the company. The discount rate is not the mechanism to do it because it's not the kind of risk you care about as a diversified investor. And finally, risk can be either discrete risk or continuous risk. Let me explain the difference between the two, and you tell me which one we're probably better at dealing with. Continuous risk is risk you're exposed to every moment of every day. So you're a U.S. company with European operations. Every time the euro-dollar exchange rate changes, your cash flows are changing, right? It's continuous risk. But let's say you're a company with exposure in the Ivory Coast, and the exchange rate is fixed. So you're saying, this is good. I don't have risk until the day you... have risk, it's one big change, discontinuous. Which risk do you think is easier to work with in valuation, continuous risk or this big discrete risk? It's continuous risk. Next week's valuation of the week, and I'll telegraph this. I was thinking about, should I do Casper or Aramco? Very similar companies, right? I think I'll do Aramco next week, and we'll hold Casper the week after because it looks like a meltdown in motion. At Casper, they lowered the offering price this morning to 13. which is where I valued it, and I'm not going to get down to 8 by next week. But with Aramco, what's a continuous risk you face when you invest in the company? Oil prices change every minute of every day. What's a discontinuous, a discrete risk you worry about with Aramco? This is a joint bet on a country, Saudi Arabia, because 80% of your GDP comes from it, and a governing, ruling, essentially, that's the discrete risk. If something really bad happens politically in Saudi Arabia, we're going to have a much easier time dealing with the continuous risk. Oil price risk is not difficult. That discrete risk is going to be difficult. So the first step in dealing with risk is putting it into the right buckets. And once you do it, you have to look at a couple of things. First is, you have to realize that not all risk is made equal. Some risk you're going to let pass through, it's going to get averaged out in your portfolio, even though you might feel uncomfortable about it. You also have to look at whose risk should I be using when I value a company? What's the obvious answer? Well, it's my money, I'll use my... Let's face it, you and I don't matter that much. The risk in a company should be seen through the eyes of the marginal investor in that company. Who's the marginal investor? They're the ones who actually affect prices at the margin. Now, you might actually think you affect prices at the margin, but you don't. I could put an order for 10,000 shares of Apple, but Apple doesn't pop just because I put a 10,000. It doesn't even matter. So the investors who make a difference at the margin have to be pretty big investors who trade a lot. So what kinds of investors are they likely to be? Probably BlackRock, Fidelity, State Street, big institutional investors. And because those investors tend to hold multiple stocks in their portfolio, you have to look at risk through their eyes. And this is where every risk and return model in finance ends up. We measure risk through the eyes of diversified investors, not because everybody's diversified. You and I might not be, but because they're the ones who set prices. And guess what? We go along for the ride. Now I could spend the next 15 weeks talking about risk and return models in finance, but they bore me. So I'll list on one page every risk and return model in finance. The oldest model, risk and return model in finance, is, of course, the capital asset pricing model. What does it do? It measures all non-diversifiable risk. Remember we said macro risk, risk you cannot get rid of in a portfolio? It measures all of the risk with one number, a beta. The nice thing about betas is they're scaled around 1, which means if a beta is 1, you're pretty close to average risk. But it works only if you're diversified. Keep that in mind. Any time you use the CAPM to get a discount rate, you're implicitly buying into a diversified investor's view of the world. CAPM came out in 1964. In the years after, there have been other models. Arbitrage pricing model came out in the late 70s, but they all share the same theme. They start with the risk-free rate. The only difference is trying to capture all of that macroeconomic risk with one beta, you allow for 4 betas or 5 betas. And in the last 30 years, as we've had access to more data, there are a new class of models that we call proxy models. They're really statistical models. What do? You look at the last 100 years, you look to see what returns on stocks have been for small cap versus large cap stocks. And you build a linkage. If you're a small cap stock, this is what you've historically earned. Those are called proxy models. But in all of those models, risk is embedded in there, and you're looking at investments through the eyes of a diversified investor. So let's go back to the CAPM. Now, much as people have abandoned it, in banks, in consulting firms, in valuations, the CAPM remains the core model that people go back to. And if you look at the breakdown for the CAPM, you need a risk-free rate. You need a beta for your company. And you need, if you do it in traditional finance class, because RM minus RF, people have no idea what the RM and RF are, but they keep plugging and chugging and plugging and chugging. But RM minus RF is an equity risk premium. It's what you demand over and above the risk-free rate to invest in equities as a class. So I need a risk-free rate, I need a beta, and I need an equity risk premium. If you give me those three numbers, I'm off to the races. So which do you think of those three is going to be the easiest to start with? Let's do the risk-free rate. I'll tell you, when I did my MBA, which was ages ago, 2 years of the MBA, I think we spent a minute and a half on risk-free rates. Because here's what I was told. When you want a risk-free rate, use the US Treasury rate. Move on. Shows you how dollar-centric my MBA program was and how much faith there was that if you had a US Treasury, it had to be risk-free. I'm going to spend more than a minute and a half on this because I think risk-free rates do matter. So I'm going to spend perhaps the rest of this class pretty much on the risk-free rate. You're saying that's going to be a waste of time? You decide at the end of the class. So let's start with what you need for something to be risk-free. For something to be risk-free, you need to have a guaranteed return. 100% of the time, you know exactly what you're going to make. Think about it. Because when you think about something being guaranteed, two conditions have to be met. First is the entity issuing the security can have no default risk. You're saying, what if it's a tiny bit? That's like being a tiny bit pregnant. I don't think that's possible. It's either you're pregnant or you're not. You're either default free or you're not. Let's not dance around. Maybe I'm a little... No, you're either default free or not. So first is no default risk. And the second is... there can be no reinvestment risk. Let me explain. Let's suppose you want a 10-year risk-free rate. And you decide to buy a 10-year T-bond. Or let's say you buy a 6-month T-bill. In fact, many classrooms, you're told 6-month T-bills are risk-free rates. Is a 6-month T-bill risk-free if you have a 10-year time horizon? It's risk-free for the next 6 months, right? At the end of 6 months, what do you need to do? Find another 6-month T-bill. At what rate? We don't know. There's reinvestment risk. You think, then I'll buy a 10-year T-bond. Well, even there you have a problem, right? Every 6 months, what does a T-bond deliver? A coupon, which has to be invested at a rate that you don't know. There's reinvestment risk. You're saying, this is hopeless. What do I do? Well, if you want to be a purist, you could buy a 10-year zero coupon T-bond. The rate on that will be a 10-year risk-free rate if the entity issuing it is default-free. See how many conditions I imposed? So if you ask me, what is the risk-free rate? I can't answer that question. You're saying you're teaching a finance class, you don't know what the risk-free rate is. I can't answer the question because you haven't given me two very critical pieces of information. One is over what time horizon, right? Because a risk-free rate for 6 months is going to be different from a risk-free rate for 10 years. And what's the other thing you didn't tell me? In what currency? Maybe it's Venezuelan Bolivar, in which case I'll come back to you in about 2 years after I've done the research because I can't figure it out right now. So when you talk about risk-free rates, time horizon matters. There's no such thing as the risk-free rate is. And the second is currency matters. Never, ever talk about risk-free rates without specifying a currency. That's sloppy. Don't say, but we're all working in the U.S. Doesn't matter. Still say in U.S. dollars. And just because you have a government bond issued in that currency doesn't mean you have a risk-free rate. That's the other misconception. I have a government bond rate, must be risk-free. Even the U.S. T-bond, when I use that as my risk-free rate in U.S. dollars, I'm getting down on my knees and please God, let the U.S. Treasury not default. You know what the argument people give for why government bonds should never default if it's in the local currency? What's the argument for why governments should not default? You want to pay off a bond, what should you be able to do? Run the printing presses faster. So in theory, no government bond in the local currency should default, right? But let me push back. Half of all sovereign defaults, which is government defaults in the last 30 years, have been local currency defaults. Why is that? Why would a country default on a bond in the local currency when they can run the printing presses faster? Let's say you run the printing presses fast. You haven't defaulted. You pay off your debt. But what's the consequence? What's going to happen? You've debased your currency. So really the choice is you're in between a rock and a hard place. You borrow too much. You can either default or debase your currency. And the question you're facing is which one's going to have worse and longer term consequences? You know what Latin America has taught us? You know why we go to Latin America every time we talk about sovereign default, right? This is the epicenter of the world for default. They mastered it. Okay? And here's what we learned. I first went to Brazil in 1997. I've gone pretty much every year since. And when I first went to Brazil in 97, it was 5 to 6 years after hyperinflation had gone through Brazil. 5,500, 6,000% inflation. And every question I got over a two-day valuation class was about, what do I do about inflation? What do I do about inflation? And here was the other consequence. No entity in Brazil in 97 was able to issue long-term bonds in Brazilian reais. You know why? Nobody would buy it. They remembered what happened the last time they bought long-term. Said, I'm not doing that. So if you were a Brazilian company, you borrowed in US dollars if you wanted to borrow. But worse, if you are the Brazilian government, every bond you issued was a dollar-denominated bond. It wasn't until 2006 that the Brazilian government was able to issue long-term bonds denominated in dollars, 15 years after hyperinflation. Take 15 years to come back from debasement. In 2015, I was in Argentina. In any just world, nobody should ever lend to this country ever again. It's a country that defaults every 4 years, right? It's like having a crazy uncle in your attic. I mean, oh my God, I can't pay the debt. No, then walks back up to the attic. But in 2015, people were back in Argentina. It was the third coming or the fourth coming of Argentina. They were all excited. It's going, we're back. You know, BlackRock was there. Fidelity was there. People seem to have completely forgotten about the three defaults that Argentina had between 2000 and 2015. It's easier to come back from default than debasement. So you know what that also tells you, right? If you want to find a risk-free rate in Indonesian rupiah, you can look up the government bond rate, but don't stop there because it might not be risk-free. So I'm going to take you through a series of tests on the risk-free rate. And by the end of this, you're going to see that a lot of stuff you hear about risk-free rates is either wrong or misleading. Let's start with a very simple scenario. Let's suppose you're valuing a company and you've estimated cash flows forever. You say, how do I do that? For a very, very, very long time. If you don't like forever, just for a very long time. You're trying to find, and you've done them in US dollars. So basically, you projected cash flows in US dollars for a really long time horizon. And you want a risk-free rate to use to discount those cash flows. And I'm going to give you some choices, and I want you to think about it and tell me which of those choices is the best one. You could use a 3-month T-bill. It's about 1.5% right now. You could use a 10-year T-bond, which when I wrote this page was 1.9%. It's since dropped off, but 1.9%. You could use a 30-year T-bond, which is about 2.2%. You can use what's called a TIPS rate. What are your TIPS? These are actually inflation-protected bonds where you're guaranteed a return plus inflation. So when it says 0.6%, you get 0.6% plus whatever the inflation rate that year is. So if inflation is 2%, you get 0.6 plus 2. If it's 9%, you get 0.6 plus 9. Or maybe the answer is none of the above. Is anybody willing to jump in and tell me which of these rates I should use and why? My cash flows last forever. What's the problem with using a 3-month T-bill rate? It's not risk-free. Think about duration, right? So 3-month T-bill rate is off the table. I projected the cash flows in US dollars. So it's a nominal cash flow, so I can't use a TIPS rate, which is a real risk-free rate. So I kind of led you to the choice, 10-year or 30-year. If all you had to do was estimate a risk-free rate, which one do you think is a better choice if your cash flows last forever? 30-year, right? If all I had to do in valuation was pick a risk-free rate, I'd use the 30-year T-bond rate. But in every single valuation you will see in this class, I use a 10-year T-bond rate. For a couple of reasons. One is, it is the only bond that's been around since 1927, so you have a lot of history, and it's issued every Monday. The rates are always fresh. The 30-year bond is kind of this strange instrument. The market for it is, you know, insurance companies in Japan. It can do strange things. So first is, I don't trust the 30-year rate as much as I trust the 10-year rate. And here's the second reason. Risk-free rate is only the start of the problem. What else do I need to estimate? Equity risk premiums, default spreads. So let's take a default spread. You know what a default spread is? What do I have to pay on a corporate bond relative to something risk-free? If I decide to use a 30-year risk-free rate, I need to find 30-year corporate bonds to compare it to. You know how many of those there are? A handful. So because I have all this other stuff waiting for me, you know what I'm going to say? Look, 30-year might be better on a purist basis, but from a pragmatic perspective, I'm going to use a 10-year bond. And in most other currencies, that's all you can get anyway, 10-year bond. So I need a 10-year default-free rate as my risk-free rate. And when I use the U.S. T-bond rate, though, I am implicitly assuming that the U.S. Treasury has no default risk. Could that change? Yeah. Nothing is forever. Okay, so 5 years from now, I might have to adjust this rate. If I started right now, I feel okay, but this is not permanent. Is everybody comfortable with the first test? Let's try a second one. How many of you plan to value European companies on the mainland? Italian, Spanish. So give me the country you're thinking about. France. So we want to value a French company, and you're going to do your cash flows, I presume, in euros, right? So you need a euro risk-free rate. And all you need to do is find a government bond denominated in euros. And here's the problem. You're going to have too many of them. I've listed a dozen government bonds, all dollar-denominated, I'm sorry, euro-denominated bonds issued by different European countries. You've got Portugal, you've got Germany, you've got, you know, France, you've got Spain, Belgium. Just a plethora of riches. So because you're valuing a French company and you're doing it in euros, which of those numbers are you going to use as your risk-free rate? He said he would take France, and I'm glad he said that because that's what most equity analysts in Europe do, and there's a problem there. What do we say risk-free rate was? It's something default-free. These are all euro-denominated bonds. They're all 10-year bonds. So why is the French 10-year euro bond rate higher than the German 10-year euro bond rate? It's not 1997, yet francs and Deutsche Mark, they're both in euros. The only reason for the difference is because people perceive default risk in France that they don't see in Germany. If you're doing a Spanish company, definitely don't want to use a Spanish bond, the Italian bond, the Portuguese, you can go, or a Greek bond. Can you say, look, it's a Greek government bond? This is a good, actually, antidote for people who think government bonds are risk-free. Is keep saying the word Greek government bond, Greek government bond. After the 10th time, you'll never use the word government bond and risk-free as if they were interchangeable. So let me come back to you because it was a little unfair. So basically, you shouldn't use the French. So what should you use as your risk-free rate? You want something as close to default-free as you can get, right? Just looking at the numbers, which of these bonds do you think is closest to default-free? And what is it about Germany that makes it closest? It's the lowest. It's not because it's Germany. So don't accuse me of having a geographical bias, because 10 years from now, the Portuguese euro bond at the lowest rate. Miracles can happen. I'd use the Portuguese euro bond rate. It's the lowest of the rates. In fact, there are some people who argue that maybe you shouldn't even use the German euro bond, because one of the problems with having a shared currency is you've lost the power to print money. There's an ECB bond, which is the European Central Bank bond. The reason I wouldn't use it is not traded as much as the German bond. It's actually the rate's very close to the German bond rate. So the risk-free rate in euros right now is minus 0.28%. We're going to come back to this. This is starting to freak you out. It should. Because when was the last econ class you took where the interest rate was negative? This freaks people out. Oh, my God, it's negative. I can't do anything more. Paralysis sets in. We've got to get past it. Right? Now let's talk about a risk-free rate in Indian rupees. The 10-year Indian government rupee bond rate on January 1st, 2020 was 6.56%. You say, this is good. I might risk-free rate. And not so fast. What do we say we have to check for? Is there default risk in the Indian government? Now, you can ask people, but what the heck are you going to get? You're going to get answers all over the place. So I cheated. Here's what I did. I went to the Moody's website, and there's actually a sovereign rating for a country. This is Moody's assessment of how much default risk there is in a country. In fact, there are two sovereign ratings for every country. One is a local currency rating. The other is a foreign currency rating. You think, what's the difference? The foreign currency rating looks at sees the risk that Moody's has sees in this country when it borrows in a different currency. So when India borrows in dollars, that's the rating. I wasn't interested in that. I went to the local, and I said, please, God, let it be AAA. Why? Because it's AAA, I'd have used the 6.56% and blame Moody's if something went wrong. It wasn't. It was Baa2. Not a terrible rating, much better than it used to be 10 years ago, but it's definitely not AAA. So if I trust Moody's, which is a dangerous thing to do, it looks like there's some default risk in the 6.56%, right? Let me help you out there. Typically, sovereign bonds with a Baa2 rating have a default spread. This is what you pay for that. The default risk of 1.59%. So I'm going to set up a math problem. I've given you the government bond rate. I've given you an assessment of default risk in India. I'd like you to tell me what the risk-free rate should be in rupees, and I'll give you the choices, and if this is the choice you would take, pick it. Maybe you'll just go with the 6.56%. So who cares about the rating? No, so that's one choice. Anybody here pick the 6.56%? Okay, good. You either heard my sales pitch or you really don't care. The second choice is to take the 6.56% and reduce it by 1.59% because you're taking the default risk out because you want something risk-free. that would give me a 4.97% risk-free rate. Or maybe I should add it on, which will give me an 8.15% rate. So should I subtract it out or add it back on? You've got a 50-50 shot. You think you should add it? How many think I should add it? How many think I... Okay. Remind me again why I'm doing this. I'm worried that 6.56% has default risk in it already. If I add it, what am I doing? I'm adding it on top of what's already worrying me. So you know what I should be doing, right? I should be subtracting it out, taking it out of the process, because I want something risk-free. I know it sounds like a lot of work, but you need to do this to clean up for default risk, because otherwise you end up double counting. But you're probably saying, where the heck did you get that 1.59%? It looks like you made it up. I do make up some stuff as I go along in this class. I'll admit it up front. But this is not made up. And I'll give you the three choices for how you can get that default spread for a country. If a country has dollar-denominated bonds, the Brazilian government, for instance, still has 10-year dollar-denominated bonds, and you know what the rate on the dollar-denominated bond is, you can get a default spread for the country by comparing it to the T-bond rate. Do you see it? Why? So the Chilean government issues dollar-denominated bonds, and the rate on that bond is 2.5%, and the T-bond rate is 1.5%. They're all both in dollars. I can't do this if the bonds are in different currencies. That difference is the default spread. So that's the first way to do it, is look, find. Unfortunately, India does not have dollar-denominated bonds. I couldn't even have done this. The second, and this is a fairly recent addition to our data sets, you heard of the CDS market? It's called a credit default swap market. It's an insurance market. Here's how it works. Let's say you buy a Brazilian bond and you worry about default risk, which you should. You can go to the CDS market and say, look, the Brazilian government promised me 6% as a rate, but I'm worried that they will default. Can I buy insurance? The CDS market says yes, and this is how much it's going to cost you, 2.5% a year. Sovereign CDS market is a market-based judgment of how much default risk there is. So if you don't trust ratings agencies, and there are about 75 countries now which have CDS spreads. So after this class, I'll send you the entire list as of January 1st, 2020, and tell you where you can find it. Actually, if you have the Bloomberg terminal, do they still have that? You can pull up this. I'll show you how to pull it up, because that's the second. But if you don't have both of those, you don't have a dollar-denominated bond or a sovereign CDS, because 75 countries, remember, there are 200 countries around the world. There are other countries you might not be able to get either. Here's the third choice. If the country has a sovereign rating, like India does, I have a lookup table I've created on my website based upon the sovereign CDS spreads and the dollar-denominated bonds. But if you tell me the rating for your country, I'll tell you what the default spread should be for your country. What if you have all three? You have a luxury of riches here. They won't all be the same number. It'd be nice if they were the same number. You have to decide which one you're going to go with. But this week's In Practice webcast, that's exactly what I'll take you through. What if you have three numbers? And I'll take the Brazilian government, which has all three numbers, and talk about, you know, what happens if the risk-free rate works out. In fact, I'll do it right now. See, I've pulled up the numbers. So let's start by trying to get risk-free rates in different currencies. So here's the first thing I did. I went looking for every government where I could find a government bond, a 10-year government bond. And you know what? Very quickly, I realized that this was a limited list. There are about 45 to 50 countries which issue 10-year government bonds. Does that mean only 45 to 50 countries actually borrow money? No, they borrow money, but they borrow from the IMF. They borrow from the World Bank. But 45 countries, I could find a 10-year government bond. Some of these government bond rates I wouldn't trust further than I can throw them, because they're not exactly market set numbers. That Zambian Kwacha 10-year bond, if you call your broker and say, can you buy the 10-year bond for me? Good luck with that. Let's see how liquid it is and who's trading it. But let's start there. Those are the government bond rates. So what's my job here? Okay. I want to go from this government bond rate to a risk-free rate. So let's take the first approach. If you look at, I've taken just a subset of countries which have either dollar bonds or euro bonds. No, so there are seven countries, Peru, Brazil, Colombia, Poland. They have all dollar bond rates. The UST bond rate on that day was 1.92%. So if I take Brazil, for instance, Brazil has, if you take the difference between their dollar rate, has a default spread of about 1.71%. So if you want to go with the government bond approach, your default spread is going to be roughly 1.71%. File that away. You can use that as your default spread. If I go to the sovereign CDS market, I told you that you can buy insurance. This is what the rates look like at the end of 2019, start of 2020. So there's Brazil, 1.74%. You're saying, what does that mean? To buy insurance against default risk in Brazil, I have to pay 1.74% a year. That's a default spread. But here's one problem with the sovereign CDS market. It's a market where you buy insurance, but the insurance is not guaranteed because there's counterparty risk. You know what that is? You buy insurance. Your insurance is only as good as the person promising to cover the insurance. It's like buying insurance from an insurance company and your house burns down. You go to the insurance company and say, sorry, guys, we ran out of money. The insurance doesn't exactly work. There's risk. So you know what I'm saying? There is, when you look at these numbers, they're not quite default free. So I'm going to cheat. When you look across these countries, notice there isn't a single country with a zero CDS. Switzerland doesn't have it. The US doesn't have it. And let's face it, if you're an investor in Swiss bonds, are you still lying awake and say, will they default? Will they default? Will they? You will default before they will default. No? So how come there is? It's because of that, that the market is not a friction-free market. So what I did was I took the US, which is pretty close to the lowest number in terms of a sovereign default spread, 0.18%, and I subtracted that from every other default spread, saying I want something closer to risk-free. If you showed this to a theorist, he would faint and say, this is terrible. I'm going to be pragmatic. I need something that measures default risk. So if you take the 1.74% and subtract out the US spread, because you want to get rid of whatever friction there is, I end up with this market giving me a signal that the Brazilian government default spread is 1.56%. You remember what it was with the dollar bond? It was, I think, 1.71. Now I have a second number floating around, 1.56%. Then I tried a third approach. Brazil has a rating of BA2, just one A. You want more A's. This is the general rule of the rating. Less A's means you're riskier. So BA2 is worse than BAA2. Don't ask me who invents this stuff and why they did it this way. And the default spread for a BA2 rated bond, at least based on my lookup table at the start of 2020, was 2.51%. So you have three numbers, right? 1.71, 1.56, 2.51%. Let's say I want to estimate a risk-free rate in Brazilian reais. The Brazilian government bond rate on January 1st, 2020 was 6.77%. That is the 10-year government bond rate. If I use the default spread I got from the dollar-denominated bond, the risk-free rate I get in reais is 5.06%. If I use the spread that I got from the sovereign CDS market adjusted for the US spread, I get 1.56, and the risk-free rate I get is 5.21%. And if I go with the spread based on the rating of 2.51%, I get a risk-free rate of 4.26%. You think this is horrible. I now have three risk-free rates. I thought this was going to be the easy part of the project. Which one should I use? I'm going to say something very strange, and you'll see why in a little while it's true. Pick one, and then be consistent. You see, what do you mean consistent? Do you think this is the last time you're going to see country default show up? Later on, when we talk about equity risk premiums, I'm going to come back and ask, how risky is your country? And then you're going to have to stick with whatever you used here. So if you use a big default spread here, you're feeling happy because your risk-free rate is lower. But if you use a big default spread here, your risk premiums, when we come back to it, are also going to be higher. Just don't mix and match and go between different numbers. Just pick one and move on. So that is a risk-free question. Yeah. Which one would I pick? I'll tell you what I do. I prefer to stay with the rating-based approach. You know why? Because I have 150 countries with ratings, 70 countries with sovereign CDS spreads, and only 40 countries with government bonds and other currencies. And because so many of my companies are in countries where I don't have the first two, I stick with the last one. So just the fact that I've... And that's something to remember in valuation. Every number, if you get caught up in what's the best way to estimate this number, you're forgetting that this is part of a bigger picture. Valuation has to be holistic. I hate using that word. I feel like Deepak Chopra. Right? I mean, but you can't just pick and choose one number. Everything gets affected by those numbers. Now let's talk about a real risk-free rate. Let's assume that you decide to do everything in real terms. You know why sometimes people do things in real terms? Because inflation becomes so high and so unmanageable that doing things in nominal terms becomes nightmarish. So in Latin America in the 90s and the first part of the last decade, people did a lot of analyses that they claimed were in real terms. They were lying sometimes, they claimed were in real terms. Because who wants, can you imagine doing a capital budgeting analysis for a Venezuelan company in Bolivar? You would run out of space on your Excel spreadsheet because the number of zeros you have to keep adding when you're 50,000% inflation is going to compound over time. You definitely are not going to do a Venezuelan Bolivar analysis. You might do things in real terms or you might do them in dollar terms. But if you decide to do things in real terms, you need a real risk-free rate. So the question I'm going to ask is a very simple one, and let's see. I showed you the TIPS rate, right? The TIPS rate is actually a real risk-free rate. You're saying, is it a real risk-free rate in dollars? Remember, once you say real, there's no currency attached. It's a real risk-free rate. I have never done a real valuation in the US because I don't have to. It's convenient enough to do things. So I'm going to be doing real valuations or real analyses in Venezuela. And there is no TIPS rate in Venezuela, or at least one you can trust. So here's my question. Do you think I can take the 0.6% that I got as the rate on a TIPS bond and use it as my real risk-free rate in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Poland, in the rest of the world? And if I do, what am I implicitly assuming about real risk-free rates and how the world works? Let me do a what if. Let's suppose we are in a world where the real risk-free rate is 5% in Brazil, 55% in Venezuela, and 0.6% in the US, real risk-free rate. And capital flows freely across markets. What's going to happen? Capital goes wherever the returns are highest, so it's going to leave the US and go to Brazil and keep pushing the rates down until you get convergence. In a world where capital moves freely across borders, the real risk-free rate has to converge on one number. Do we live in that world? Not even in my dreams. Capital has restrictions, it can't flow. But this makes it so convenient. So you know what I'm going to do? If you ask me to do a real analysis in Venezuela, so let's assume, I'm going to do what economists do. When you have a problem, just assume the problem away. And so let's assume we live in a world where capital flows freely. Let's use the 0.6% risk-free rate. And if you don't like that, I'll give you another way to do it. But if you want a real risk-free rate, unfortunately, the TIPS rate is it. That's what you can use as your real risk-free rate. So if you have no default-free entity, here are your choices. One is to do just what I did, take the government bond rate and subtract out a default spread to come up with a risk-free rate. The second is to actually do your analysis in real terms. That way you don't have to deal with the local currency. The third is to do the entire analysis in a different currency. For almost 20 years in Latin America, between 1991 and 2010, almost every analysis done was either in real terms or in US dollar terms. So you could be a consumer product company that operates only in Brazil or in Argentina or anywhere else, but when you did capital budgeting, everything was done in US dollar terms. Why? Because people did not want to deal with inflation in the local currency. But when you have high and volatile inflation in the local currency, it's like having an elephant in your living room. Every time it moves, you will notice. And what I mean by that is you think you're avoiding it by doing everything in dollar terms, right? But if inflation is wild and volatile, where else is it going to show up? Because if you decide to do everything in dollar terms, your cash flows have to be in dollars, which means you have to convert your nominal real cash flows into dollars, which means you have to forecast out exchange rates. You think you're running away from one problem, it's going to chase you down somewhere else. You say, what do I do about it? Move to a different country, I guess. Yeah. But if you have high and volatile inflation, you can't make it go away just because you decide to do things. So when Latin American companies talk about dollarizing their numbers, I say, what does that even mean? You just convert things into dollars and all the problems go away? They don't, they just go under the surface. So now let's use what I just did to look at risk-free rates in different currencies. So what I do at the start of every year and midway through the year, so this is a fairly recent graph, is I take those government bond rates you saw, I back out the default spread, so that's the red portion, and I end up with the blue portion, which is risk-free rate. So basically, the full bar is the government bond rate. Taking out the red gives me the blue bar, which is the risk-free rate. So let me start with an obvious statement. Risk-free rates vary across currencies. Now I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. And how you answer this question is going to tell me whether you can crack the currency code. If you answer this question correctly, you'll have no problem with currencies. So there's a lot of, I've added a lot of weight to this question, saying, oh my God, this is going to mean the end of my life. Now, don't take it too seriously. Why do risk-free rates vary across currencies? Notice what I didn't ask you why government bond rates vary, because that could be risk. But if I've cleaned up for default risk, why do risk-free rates vary across currencies? What if I gave you an A if you got the answer right now? You don't have to do the quizzes, final exam. I don't even know whether I have the power to give it. No. Act like I'm going to give you an A. I will not, but act like I will. Give it your best shot. Why do risk-free rates vary across currencies? You want to try? Anybody?
Oh.
Inflation. Guy gets a virtual A. You still take the quizzes and the final, because I don't think Stern counts virtual A's. Inflation. High inflation currencies, help me out, they will have high risk-free rates. Low inflation currencies could have low risk-free rates, and deflationary currencies could have what? Negative risk-free rates. So if somebody asks you, can risk-free rates be negative, you should give the answer that I gave when I posted about negative risk-free rates. It's uncommon, but it's not unnatural. Now, do you think, though, that... So basically, if I pick a lower risk-free rate currency, let's say I do my analysis in Swiss francs, my discount rates are all going to be much lower, right? This is good, low discount rates. Do you think my valuations will be affected by what currency I choose to do the valuation in? Let's say I pick a high inflation currency. What's the bad news? I decide to do my analysis in Kenyan shilling. I have a Kenyan company. I'm going to end up with a high discount rate. That's the bad news. What's the good news? That high inflation that pushes up my discount rate, remember my cash flows have to be in Kenyan shillings, will also help me on my cash flows. What one hand gives you, the other hand will take away. And what one hand takes away, the other hand will give you. As long as you stay consistent, your value for a company should be currency invariant. Right now you're saying, right. We'll actually do it. We'll actually take a company valued in dollars, then valued in rupees, and see if we get the same answer. But if you do it right, it should be currency invariant. But the key driver here is inflation. And once you get that insight, you can now compute a risk-free rate in any currency. Remember, even with the government bond approach, there are only 41 currencies I could do it. But let's say I ask you, what is the Egyptian pound risk-free rate? There's no 10-year government bond in Egypt. You say, what the heck do I do? Remember, the only reason risk-free rates vary across currencies is the inflation rate, right? Do we know the U.S. dollar risk-free rate at least? The T-bond rate is 1.92%. So to get an Egyptian pound risk-free rate, what are the two additional numbers I have to bring into the equation? I need an inflation rate in U.S. dollars, which is easy. You know why it's easy? Because I have the T-bond rate and the TIPS rate. T-bond rate is 1.92%. The TIPS rate is 0.6%. What's that difference? That's actually expected inflation. The U.S., don't listen. There's a macroeconomic forum this evening. Come and listen and be respectful. They'll probably tell you what the expected inflation is going to be. Ignore it completely. Go out there, use 1.32%. Because there's real money behind it. There's billions of dollars behind it. So inflation rate in the U.S. is, let's say, 1.5%. And I told you the inflation rate in Egyptian pounds is 15%. Here's all you need to do. Take the U.S. risk-free rate as your starting point. Let's say it's 2%. Take the inflation difference. If you're in a hurry, you know what you can do. Just take the difference in numbers, 13.5%, and add it to 2%. But the right thing to do, there's a compounding effect, and it kind of adds to it. The risk-free rate that I would get with those numbers would be about 15.57%. Inflation is what drives difference in risk-free rates. And once you see that, you can get a risk-free rate in any currency. One final point about currencies. We're incredibly sloppy. We collectively, in business and valuation, about currencies. You know, a couple of months ago, I was in Istanbul doing a valuation seminar. And a lot of CEOs and CFOs of companies. And I said, you guys are insane. Not a great way to start the presentation. You know what Turkish companies do? This has been true for 40 years. These are Turkish companies which have all of their operations in Turkey. They get their cash flows in lira, but they consistently borrow money in euros and dollars, which in corporate finance is an absolute no-no. I said, are you guys out of your minds? Why do you keep borrowing in dollars or euros? Because you know exactly what's going to happen. And every 10 years in Turkey, it happens like clockwork. You borrow in dollars, your business is all in lira. What causes the implosion? The lira drops by 30%. Overnight, every company is technically bankrupt. And what's the definition of insanity? You keep doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different outcome. After the seventh crisis, I said, aren't you guys tired of doing this? Why do you keep doing it? So one of the Turkish CFOs, a big Turkish company, I won't name the company, says, oh, it's because it's cheaper to borrow in dollars. I said, really? Tell me more. He said, when I borrow in dollars, it cost me only 6%, but now I borrow in lira, it cost me 15%. So I had to hit him with an analogy that I didn't like. I said, you know what? I was coming from California. I left San Diego yesterday, and when I left, I checked my iPhone on what the temperature was. I left San Diego, it's always 70 degrees and sunny. It's at 70 degrees. And then, of course, the iPhone, I had to put an airplane mode. I landed in Turkey, and iPhones are incredibly clever as to where you are. So in Turkey, I said, what's the temperature in Istanbul? It said 20 degrees. I thought I'd landed on the North Pole. Is 20 less than 70? Go along. Yes. But what's the difference? When I left San Diego, the temperature was in Fahrenheit. When I landed in Istanbul, the temperature was in Celsius. Is 20 degrees Celsius lower than 70 degrees? Barely. You know how to convert it, right? 20 times 1.8 plus 32, 68 degrees. You're pretty much at the same temperature. Now do you see what this has to do with dollars and lira rates? Is 3% lower than, or 6% lower than 15? Yes. But is 6% in dollar terms lower than 15% in lira terms? I don't know until I bring the difference in inflation. Maybe the inflation rate in lira is 14%, in which case it's a bargain to borrow at 16%. But we have to stop stating things without specifying the currency we're talking about. So now, one more test on risk-free rates, right? And we'll let it go. The 10-year, actually, we have two more, but no. On January 1st, 2020, it should say 2020, sorry, change the 2019 to 2020, the T-bond rate was 1.92%. And that looks low. How low? Depends on how old you are as to how low it'll look. I mean, people talk about what's a normal rate. If somebody says a normal T-bond rate is 5 to 6%, they've been working too long. They probably started in the 1980s. I mean, you know that behavioral finance, people have discovered that what you call normal is what you observe between the ages of 30 and 35. So if you're 75, your normal is defined by what you saw 40 years ago. So this rate is really low. This is crazy people, you know, people pushing the rates down. The Fed did it. You've heard that, you know, variants of that on CNBC. So the rate looks low. So you know what people feel the urge to do, right? They feel the urge to replace it with something more normal. So let me ask you a question. You see that 1.92%, you say, that's a really low number. It's now down to 1.56%. It's even lower. So I'm going to ask you whether I should just use that rate because that's a rate, or should I replace it with something more normal, maybe an average for the last 20 years, the last 30 years, the last 40 years. Let's say they take the average for the last 30 years. Let's say it's 5%. Should I replace my risk-free rate with something more normal? After all, we do this in the rest of valuation, right? We change margins, we normalize things. Should I normalize risk-free rates? Let's play a game. Let's suppose we decide to normalize risk-free rates. We replace the 1.92% with 5%, right? So I have a higher risk-free rate. Tell me what's going to happen. I'll have a higher cost of equity, a higher cost of capital, higher discount rate, holding all else constant. What's going to happen? My value is going to be lower, probably much lower than the price. And then you could say, don't buy the stock. Put your money in the risk-free asset. And earn how much? 5%. It's only in your dreams that you can earn 5%. There is no 5% rate. You made this up. This is not like margins. A risk-free rate is an actual opportunity cost. This is what you can make out there. And you might not like 1.92%. I might not like 1.92%. I might not think it's fair. But I have to live in the world I'm in, not the world I wished I was in. Don't mess with the risk-free rate. Don't say this, I'll make... And people, you're going to see this with the negative risk-free rates. People get do all kinds of crazy things to just get away from the minus number. Don't mess with risk-free rates. Whatever the rate is what it is. Just move on. And of course, we ask them, why is the risk-free rate low? This is when the conspiracy theories come out. It's the Fed that did it. I mean, if you watch CNBC, in fact, you know, watching CNBC, they talk every time the central bank meets, will they lower rates? Will they raise rates? It used to be Ben Bernanke, then Janet Yellen, and now Powell. You know, will they do this? About 4 years ago, I took my wife and two of my kids to the Federal Reserve. You can actually go for a tour of the Federal Reserve downtown. It's neat. It's this big building with iron bars, and you walk in. I almost made myself persona non grata the minute after we walked in, because this young guide comes up. She's, you know, 25 years old, probably a college student they hired to be the guide. She comes up, and I almost asked the question, can you take me to the interest rate room? Because if you watch CNBC, there must be this room, right? Because where Powell goes and he says, I'm going to make the T-bond rate 2.33%, the T-bill rate here. There is no interest rate room. What's the only rate the Fed controls? It's called the Fed funds rate. The second question to that guide was going to be, can you take me to that window? I'd like to borrow some Fed funds. You can try, but it's not going to work. It's an intra-bank overnight rate. That's the only rate they set. Everything else is set by the market. But you think, but the Fed sets rates. This is so deeply embedded in our psyche. So people are then, I say, how do you explain the low rates for the last 10 years? Let me try. In econ, do you remember this equation called the Fisher equation? Fisher equation says the interest rate is a risk-free rate plus an expected real interest rate. That's basically, expected inflation plus an expected real interest rate. It's nothing to do with currencies, that's simple. So here's what I decided to do. I went back to 1954, and I got the T-bond rate every year. It's a market set number. And each year, I found two numbers. I got the inflation rate from that year and the real GDP growth that year. You know, real interest rates and real GDP growth are kind of rough proxies for each other, and I added those two numbers up. So as an example, if the inflation rate is 5% and real GDP growth is 3, 5 plus 3 is 8, I'm going to call that my intrinsic risk-free rate. See this red line? That's my intrinsic risk-free rate that I'm getting by adding the two numbers together. Do you see why interest rates have been low for the last 10 years? It's because inflation has been low and growth has been anemic. You add low plus low, you get low. Has the Fed had an effect? Yes, at the margin. But rates are low for fundamental reasons. This is when people say, well, central banks can raise rates, lower rates. Central banks can play at the margin. In fact, if I'll send you a link to something I wrote 6 years ago where I compared Ben Bernanke to the Wizard of Oz. You see the movie? If you see the movie, the Wizard of Oz has absolutely no powers. His power comes from the fact that people think he has powers. The power of the Fed comes from the perception that the Fed, it's like this gigantic illusion. You could maintain the illusion. So if you're saying rates are low because central banks have conspired to keep it low, let go of your conspiracy theories. It's just going to get in the way. You know how many people have stayed out of stocks for the last 10 years because they're convinced that the central bank is out to get them? I'm sure every night before they go to bed, they're checking the closets. Is Powell in there? Is Powell in there? No, is he going to come out and get me? No, he doesn't care about you. You're just another investor. Just let it go. Let's talk about negative risk-free rates. So a few months ago, I was in Europe, and I know this, of course, came up. You're doing analysis in euros. We have negative risk-free rates. What do we do about it? I said, why do you need to do something about it? And they told me, they said, if you have negative risk-free rates, that can't happen. And we already saw that why that's not true. You can have negative risk-free rates, and what has to be true fundamentally of deflation and terrible growth, you're going to get negative risk-free rates. Do you see why Japan and Europe have negative risk-free rates? they've got a fundamental problem that's not going to go away. What's that problem? An aging population. That's why it's almost an inexorable problem. If half the people in your country are 65 and older, your real growth can't be 10% a year, it can't be 8% a year. So I don't mean to be the bearer of bad news, or maybe I like bearing bad news. Europe and Japan's best days are way behind them. And that's what the bond market... I'm not saying you can't have a good year here and there. But what you're seeing in the bond market is a reflection of that pessimism that people have about the future. So can they be negative? Yes. It creates some freaky, freaky outcomes, right? In Europe now, when you there are parts of Europe where you borrow money to buy a house, you know what happens every month? You get a check from the bank. This is mind-boggling. I bought the house, they're mailing me a check. You're saying, this is amazing. You probably won't have a job because there's no real growth, but that's a different problem. Eh? But people feel uncomfortable because it's never... no valuation class you ever took used negative numbers. So we will come back and talk about negative risk-free rates because... don't put your stuff away. I have 5 minutes left. I use every minute of every session. But I'm going to send you some ways you can solve this in your weekly challenge. I'll put it around risk-free rates. Watch the session this Friday about risk-free rates because it'll give you the basis for it. So let's talk about risk premiums. Let me set the table. I'll tell you what I'm trying to measure with the equity risk premium. It's the premium demand over and above the risk-free rate for investing in stocks collectively. So let's take the US. Let's work in dollar terms. Right now, if you don't want to take any risk and you're willing to invest long-term, how much can you make? 1.6, 1.7, whatever the T-bond rate is. Now, I'm trying to get you to take your money out of stocks and put it, out of that T-bond and put it into stocks. I need to at least give you an expectation that you can make more than 1.9%. You could be disappointed after the fact. The equity risk premium is what you charge over and above. Let me tell you how I would start to estimate equity risk premiums. And I'll tell you why I don't do it anymore, but this is the way most people around the world, including in your corporate finance class, you might have been taught this as well. It's look backwards. How is looking backwards going to answer? Let's say you took the last 50 years and you found that stocks over the last 50 years made 9% and T-bonds made only 4%. So over the last 50 years, what did you do? You earned 5% more than the T-bond rate. You use that as your equity risk premium going forward. When you do that, there are two things you're assuming. One is what's called mean reversion. What is that? You assume things always revert back to the way they used to be. Is that a safe assumption? It's safe as long as you're in a stable, in terms of equation. If you have a stable equation, you always revert back. And for much of the 20th century, it worked really well in the US. Why? You had the most stable mean reverting economy of all time. For much of the 20th century, the US was the global economy. Things reverted back like machines. And you could use historical risk premiums. You know when it becomes dangerous? Is when there's a break in the equation. Something changes. Until 2008, when people used historical equity risk premiums, I would let it go. You said, look, you know, you pick what you want. No, you're assuming mean reversion. 2008 for me was a breaking point. Why? Not just because of the crisis, but it told me the world shifted. I mean, it had been shifting for a while, but that was the message. Hey, guys, you don't live in a US-centric global economy. This is a global economy where you could have troubles one place spill over into another. It was a reminder that mean reversion becomes much more dangerous than that. Here's the second problem. When I use a historical risk premium, these are updated through the start of 2020. And you ask me, what's the historical risk premium for the US? You know what my answer is? Somewhere between, let's say, the 3.5% and 13%. You see why I get so many different numbers? It depends on the slice of history I look at. It depends on whether I'm comparing to T-bills and T-bonds. It even depends on how I compute my average. You're saying, what the hell does that even mean? There are two ways you can compute an average. A simple average, take 50 numbers and divide by 50. The other is a compounded average. So you say you use a historical premium. This gives you so much room to hang yourself. It's terrifying. But here's the other problem, and I think this goes back to statistics and the way statistics get taught. You know what the problem with statistics classes is? At least you might not be true for your class. is by the time you're done with the class, the first thing you're thinking about is how quickly can I sell this book back? Because I don't think I'll ever use this again. Unfortunately, we forget our statistics when we get into finance. Because in statistics, when I compute an average across 50 numbers, what am I trained to put in brackets below it? A standard error, to tell the world, look, guys, I am a little uncertain. You want to see the standard error in my historical risk premium? If I go all the way back to 1927, that's 92 years of history. That's a lot of data, right? My standard error is 2.2%. So when I tell you the risk premium going back to 1927 is 4.83%, second decimal point. The standard error is 2.2%.